Today is Wednesday, June the 18th, 2025. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how big tech companies and our government are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a 3-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. That's www.prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Mind-boggling sums of money have been and are invested in the development of generative AI. In terms of market share revenue, Meta has struggled and fading in AI momentum. Where is Meta's llama in the generative AI chatbot market? The leaders as of June 2025 in the United States are OpenAI ChatGPT, which has 60.6% of the market, Microsoft Copilot, 14.3% of the market, Google Gemini, 13.4%, Perplexity, which is privately owned, 6.2%, Anthropic Claude AI, 3.2%, and XAI Grok, which is owned by Elon Musk, at 0.8%. It's important to keep in mind that the generative AI market is still evolving rapidly, with new innovations and partnerships constantly emerging, which can shift market dynamics. Meta spent $39 billion in 2024 and expects to spend $65 billion for 2025. Meta is in a $15 billion gamble to catch up. Meta has invested $15 billion in a company, Scale AI, and hired CEO Alexander Wang to lead a new AI superintelligence lab. This bold move aims to revive Meta's AI game after weak Llama 4 results and a talent exodus in 2024. Meta just made a $15 billion move. It took a 49% stake in Scale AI, a startup known for high-quality data labeling. This isn't your average investment. It's a power play to revive Meta's fading AI momentum. Meta also hired Scale AI CEO Alexander Wang to lead a new superintelligence lab. It's a bold decision, but questions are already piling up. Why Meta wants Scale AI in its corner? Modern AI needs good data, not just any kind, but labeled, curated, top-tier training data. That's where Scale AI shines. OpenAI, Anthropic, and other AI leaders have used Scale's data to train their best models. Meta, on the other hand, has struggled. Its Llama 4 model did not impress. It fell behind Chinese rivals like DeepSeek. Even Meta's own AI teams complained about the lack of quality data. So this deal makes sense, at least on paper. Can Alexander Wang really lead a superintelligence lab? Wang is young. He's just 28 years of age, but well known in the Valley. He's confident, connected, and known for getting things done. Still, this new role is a big leap. He has not led a top-tier AI research lab before. Meta is reportedly trying to bring in experts like Jack Ray from DeepMind to balance things out. The mix of new energy and proven talent might work or end in another Meta misfire. This feels familiar, because it is. Remember when Meta bought WhatsApp for $19 billion or Instagram for $1 billion? People laughed at those deals back then. Today, both are core parts of Meta's empire. Maybe Zuckerberg sees this scale AI move similarly as another misunderstood bet that pays off later. But AI isn't social media, and data is not as easy to monetize. The AI data race is getting crowded. Scale AI isn't the only game in town. Competitors like Turing, Surge AI, and LM Arena are waiting to grab clients. Some labs might avoid scale now that Meta partially owns it. Turing says it already seeing more interest from customers who want a neutral partner. Scale may struggle to stay on top if these firms step up their game. Meta's real challenge is catch up or fade out. Meta lost 4.3% of its top talent in 2024, which is a big hit, especially with OpenAI and Google charging ahead. OpenAI's next flagship model, GPT-5, is around the corner. It could blow past anything Meta is building now, including the upcoming Llama models. To stay relevant, Meta has to move fast. It can't afford another Llama-style disappointment. Will this work, or is Meta just desperate? Nobody knows yet. The AI world moves fast. What looks like a smart strategy today could flop tomorrow. Wang has energy. Scale AI has experience. Meta has money. But OpenAI, Google, and Anthropic aren't slowing down either. For Meta, this is a race, not a marathon, but a sprint with billions on the line. So if you see Zuckerberg smiling, it's not just because of Threads. It's because he hopes this $15 billion gamble won't become another AI headache. OpenAI is considering the nuclear option against Microsoft. The two companies have a quite unique relationship that could make such a conflict particularly disastrous. Microsoft doesn't own OpenAI outright, and the startup isn't technically beholden to the software giant. But Microsoft provides the cloud computing infrastructure necessary to fuel OpenAI's tools, and Microsoft earns a large percentage of OpenAI's profits until the startup repays Microsoft's initial investments. After the initial investment is paid, Microsoft will retain a large stake in the company and earn a certain percentage of OpenAI's profits until it hits a cap. But again, because it's not technically owned by Microsoft, OpenAI is still technically its own organization. The two companies, which are bound together by cash flows and an entwined product base, have been undergoing a turbulent negotiation surrounding OpenAI's desire to turn itself into a for-profit company. Microsoft appears to be resistant to some of those goals. Now a new report claims that the staff at OpenAI have prepped a nuclear option in case the negotiations do not go the way they want them to go. The Wall Street Journal reports that OpenAI may run to the federal government and accuse Microsoft of anti-competitive practices. Were this to happen, OpenAI's executives claim that they would seek a federal regulatory review of the terms of the contract between them and Microsoft, with an eye towards identifying potential antitrust violations. For Microsoft, calling in the antitrust regulatory body could be the most extreme form of betrayal that exists. OpenAI might also launch a media campaign to air the duo's dirty laundry in public. OpenAI's effort to become a for-profit company is presumably pivotal to its long-term growth strategy, a strategy that could be strangled if Microsoft holds onto it too tightly. The journal notes that much of the strife between the two companies seems to revolve around Microsoft's continual ownership over large parts of OpenAI's business. The companies continue to be at odds over how much of OpenAI Microsoft would own if it converts into a public benefit corporation. Microsoft is currently asking for a larger stake in the new company than OpenAI is willing to give, people familiar with the matter said. OpenAI has to complete the conversion by the end of the year, or it risks losing $20 billion in funding. Microsoft has made significant investments in OpenAI with a total funding commitment of $13 billion. This partnership, which began with an initial $1 billion investment in 2019, has been pivotal in the current AI boom. Microsoft is entitled to 49% of OpenAI Global LLC's profits, capped at an estimated 10 times their investment. This profit-sharing structure kicks in after early investors are paid back their initial profits. The precise cap on Microsoft returns has not been publicly disclosed, but could range significantly. A crucial part of the agreement is that Microsoft Azure is the exclusive cloud provider for OpenAI. This means all OpenAI larger language models and applications run on Azure infrastructure, generating revenue for Microsoft. Microsoft has integrated OpenAI models into its commercial software, including Microsoft 365 Copilot, which is an AI assistant for Office applications, and Azure OpenAI Service, which allows Azure users to build generative AI applications with OpenAI models. The partnership has been highly strategic for both companies, giving Microsoft early and exclusive access to cutting-edge AI technology and providing OpenAI with the massive computing power needed for AI development. However, recent reports indicated growing tensions between the two companies, with OpenAI reportedly considering accusing Microsoft of anti-competitive behavior as it seeks to renegotiate terms, including reducing the revenue share given to Microsoft and eliminating Azure's exclusive cloud hosting rights. These discussions are also tied to OpenAI's desire to restructure into a for-profit public benefit corporation and potentially pursue an IPO, which requires Microsoft's approval. While deeply invested in OpenAI, Microsoft has also been developing its own in-house AI model, known as MAI, and diversifying its AI offerings on Azure to avoid being solely reliant on OpenAI. Essentially, Microsoft provided the initial funding with certain terms in the agreement. OpenAI is using the threat of antitrust action as a strong bargaining chip to force Microsoft to concede on key terms in their evolving relationship. The biggest fear was that AI would steal our jobs. In reality, it's replacing those of people who are learning how to work. As thousands of young graduates prepare to take their first steps on the job market, an unexpected obstacle stands in their way: artificial intelligence. The technological promise that was supposed to relieve us of repetitive tasks seems, paradoxically, to be blocking the access of new generations to the professional world. Traditionally, young people start their careers with internships, junior positions, or simple assignments that allow them to learn and work their way up. But as Anish Raman, head of business opportunities at LinkedIn, explains, the first rung of the career ladder is disappearing. The reason for this? It is precisely these introductory tasks. Administrative, repetitive, often unskilled, that companies are now entrusting to generative AI. Tech giants such as Amazon, Google, and Microsoft are already automating tasks previously carried out by young employees, writing bits of code, data entry, administrative assistance. The result? A drop in the on-the-job learning opportunities. According to the New York Federal Reserve, the unemployment rate for young graduates in the United States is 5.8%, compared with 6.2% for younger workers. This rise is partly linked to the rapid automation of entry-level tasks. Companies such as Duolingo and Shopify are already actively reducing the recruitment of juniors for these roles, preferring to entrust them to AI systems. It is a bleak future for young people. Chris Hyman's CEO of Indeed points out that in around two-thirds of professions, more than half of the skills required can be performed satisfactorily or even excellently by current AI. While AI does not completely replace jobs, it does make many stages of the traditional training pathways obsolete. The paradox is striking. Companies are warning of a shortage of skilled labor, but no longer offer the conditions to train this talent. In Europe, this tension is all the more marked because companies are struggling to recruit experienced technical profiles, while young people can no longer access the positions that would allow them to become such. If the trend continues, AI will not eliminate millions of jobs in one fell swoop. It will simply prevent future professionals from emerging. And in the long term, there is a great risk that we will end up with powerful tools, but without enough qualified human resources to supervise and develop them. But for this to be of benefit to everyone, we need to rethink professional integration and guarantee a space for human learning where machines are gaining ground. Big tech firms attribute every job cut they make to artificial intelligence, regardless of whether that's true. The tech industry has spent the past few years telling everyone that the artificial intelligence tools they're building are about to change the world. But until recently, executives at the largest tech firms haven't been willing to spell out what exactly that means for the hundreds of thousands of white-collar staffers at their own companies. Earlier this year, Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff told a podcaster that his company might not hire any new engineers this year because of incredible productivity gains from AI tools. And Amazon CEO Andy Jassy spoke out on the subject in a company-wide memo, sandwiched between praise for Amazon's AI products like Alexa and Bedrock and recommendations that employees be curious about AI. Jassy finally said what AI tools will mean for Amazon. AI is going to replace corporate jobs. We will need fewer people doing some of the jobs that are being done today and more people doing other types of jobs, Jassy wrote. It's hard to know exactly where this nets out over time, but in the next few years, we expect that this will reduce our total corporate workforce as we get efficiency gains from using AI extensively across the company. Jassy's note will probably be welcome news to the Amazon shareholders and unnerving to many white-collar workers inside and outside the company. But it's worth teasing out what's actually novel here. After all, Amazon's emphasis on cutting corporate headcount is nothing new. The company has been slashing corporate jobs for years, including through mass layoffs in 2022 and 2023, and a year in bureaucracy that Jassy declared last fall. That's already reduced its overall headcount. The number of people Amazon employed at the end of 2024 was roughly flat compared to the preceding 2 years and about 50,000 below a peak of 1.6 million staff in 2021, according to corporate filings, though those figures include both corporate and blue-collar staff. At the same time, Amazon and its rivals are pouring tens of billions of dollars apiece this year into AI and cloud-related capital expenditures. At some point, all that spending has to translate into revenue, and there's no better way for Amazon to sell its AI tools to clients than to point all the jobs it's been able to cut within its own ranks as a result of the technology. There's almost certainly a similar dynamic at play at Microsoft, where an executive touted the productivity benefits of OpenAI's power tools shortly before laying off staff. There's growing evidence that AI products are making some white-collar workers more productive. But it's worth keeping in mind that big tech firms have had an incentive these days to attribute every job cut they make to AI, regardless of whether that's true. Expect more memos like Jassy's from other tech executives in the future. Meta, WhatsApp is officially getting ads. Meta has hinted at bringing ads to WhatsApp for years, and now they're finally here. Meta is also adding sponsored channels and subscriptions. WhatsApp is rolling out ads. Meta announced that it will now show ads from businesses through its stories-like status feature. The status feature lives within WhatsApp's updates tab and allows users to share disappearing text, photo, voice notes, or video messages. But now you might see sponsored content in addition to the updates shared by friends or family members. Meta has been considering bringing advertising to WhatsApp for years now, an idea its founders were entirely against. Though, Meta reversed plans to roll out in-app ads in 2020. WhatsApp head Will Cathcart confirmed in 2023 that the company was still working on an implementation. Last year, Meta made more than $160 billion in ad revenue. Meta says it will tailor the ads to your interest by using limited information, including your country or city, language, the channels you follow, and how you interact with ads on the platform. You can also change your ad preferences from Meta's Accounts Center if you've opted into the hub. We've been talking about our plans to build a business that does not interrupt your personal chats for years, and we believe the Updates tab is the right place for these new features to work. Meta writes in its update, the company says it will never sell or share your phone number to advertisers, adding that it won't use your messages, calls, or groups to inform its ads. This isn't the only change Meta is making to WhatsApp. The company will also start showing promoted channels when you click on the Explore button to find new ones to follow. It's also rolling out the ability to subscribe to channels to receive exclusive updates as well. Here's how scammers can be tricking you when you are unsubscribing from emails. Cybercriminals are exploiting the unsubscribe button in emails as a phishing tactic. Clicking on these malicious links can expose personal information, install malware, or steal login credentials. Cybercriminals are using the unsubscribe button as a new scam tactic, even though it may feel like taking control in a world full of spam emails. Experts now caution that what appears to be a simple inbox cleaning could actually jeopardize your security and data. Here's how scammers are phishing users with phony unsubscribe links and what you can do to protect yourself. Scammers turn email fatigue into a phishing opportunity. Experts in cybersecurity have expressed concern about a phishing technique that is becoming more and more prevalent. Scam emails that pose as unsubscribe links. Users are frequently asked for personal information or sent to malicious websites when they click on these. These malicious links have the ability to expose private information, install malware, and collect login credentials. Even worse, the emails might appear to be genuine newsletters or promotions, making it hard for the typical user to spot fraud. Why clicking unsubscribe can be risky now. Previously, clicking unsubscribe was considered a safe way to manage marketing emails. However, hackers have weaponized this feature. Once clicked, these fraudulent links can confirm to attackers that your email is active, opening the door for more targeted spam or scams. Some may trick you into thinking you've opted out while silently adding your data to a larger breach campaign. How do you stay safe from unsubscribe scams? To protect yourself, avoid clicking unsubscribe links in suspicious or unexpected emails. Instead, use your email platform's built-in tools to report or block spam. Gmail, Outlook, and others allow you to unsubscribe safely via your own verified interface. Also, check the sender's address carefully. Misspellings or odd domains are red flags. Finally, keep your antivirus software updated and avoid interacting with emails from unknown sources altogether. Even the most common digital habits are now being exploited by today's hackers. Even though clearing your inbox might seem innocuous, they might gain access through that innocuous unsubscribe click. To protect your digital identity, be vigilant. Double-check all links and use reliable resources. Google prepares to reduce Pixel 6a battery due to overheating issue amid fire reports. Pixel 6a owners may soon see their devices limited in terms of battery life. Google is preparing to reduce the battery to avoid a potential overheating issue. Earlier this year, Google updated Pixel 4a that effectively made device useless. Battery life was cut to a point where the device needed to be charged after as little as a couple of hours. Google offered battery replacement to many, but the issue at hand was never fully confirmed, though it was seemingly to avoid an overheating issue that could leave devices catching fire. Now we're getting a repeat, as Google is apparently preparing similar measures for 2022's Pixel 6a, right as reports of devices catching fire has been circulating. Hidden within Android 16, Google will reduce the battery capacity of Pixel 6a via an upcoming software update and will recommend a battery replacement to users of the device. Due to a potential battery overheating issue, battery capacity and charging performance are reduced, and battery replacement is recommended. Support options are available. In another snippet, Google specifies that this new reduction to the Pixel 6a's battery will take place after the device has reached 400 charge cycles, with a warning notification being shown after 375 cycles. Your battery has reached 375 charge cycles. Due to a potential battery overheating issue, when your battery reaches 400 charge cycles, the battery capacity and charging performance will be reduced and battery replacement is recommended. Support options are available. Reports of Pixel 6a phones are limited thus far, but incidents aren't exactly isolated either. In a statement shared with 9to5 Google, Google says this update is coming and will be mandatory. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and so much more. And Isaac had a question: why does it seem so long for some tech issues to get resolved, even when they seem small to me? And I get this. And there's all kinds of different things that are going on in IT, and there are a number of different factors that are going to roll into this. And it is something like calling a locksmith for a stuck door. It seems simple from the outside, and yet there might be some very hidden implications inside the overall mechanism. And that overall mechanism is the entire corporation. Let's start off with the big one, and that is information technology goes through and they will triage based upon overall impact, not just the visibility of one particular person, even an important person, even something which you feel is very important. A small printer issue is a perfect example here. And it has to be prioritized in amongst so many different things. I remember somebody reached out to me once and they said, hey, I can't print. Well, there's a bigger problem at hand right now. The servers are currently down. Well, I still can't print. I get that. But the entire company is down. We have problems bigger than your printing issue at the moment. No offense. I will get back to you. I will come back to you here in a short while, but I need to make sure that everybody can access our hard drive out on the network. And this is something that people have a big battle with, and they don't realize that some of these smallest issues are going to have to be on hold until we tackle the medium-sized and the big-sized issues. If there's a company-wide issue or a regional issue or something that is just part of the bigger picture, we're going to deal with biggest picture first and then move on down through all of these other items. Next up, there are very intermittent issues, and these intermittent issues are going to also take a lot of time to resolve. Sometimes, every once in a while, I can't print a PDF from my system. And this is something, you know, somebody might come to me with. And, okay, I can look at that. But if it's only every once in a while, you need to reach out to me when that's happening. And I can look at what is going on at that particular moment. Frequently, we will be called out. Information technology will be aware of this issue that happens once every 3 weeks. Okay, but if it happens only once every 3 weeks and it only happens for an hour, we have to schedule and be there during that hour. We have to also know that it's only happening during that hour. So one of the things that I frequently will ask people, hey, is the issue happening right now? Okay, so this is a time when I can come on out and I can take care of it. Oh, it's not happening right now. It's only happening once in a while. Well, I need you to reach out to me when it's happening, and then we can look at everything then. So there's all of these different things that are just winding up, putting that fix off, because it's just going to happen like that. And there are a lot of different issues that may factor into this as well. There are background dependencies. And we may say, you know what, we need to have you reboot your system. We may need to have you just try that first. And I had somebody reach out to me. Oh, my computer is acting up. I know when I reboot it, it goes away. But I don't want to reboot my system right now. I want you to come on out and fix it. That's not always a practical thing. See, when we have technicians lined up, we have a series of technicians in a company, and it all depends on the size of the company. I do know that for a long time, 11 years, I worked as the sole in-house nerd. Everything. I did everything from A to Z that was even nerd-related. So sometimes I'd say, look, reboot this time. Even reboot next time. Let me know when it's happening each time. You know that a reboot fixes it. Now, a reboot, we know that it fixes it because this is something that happens all the time. The system just goes into whatever direction it's going to go in, where it breaks whatever functionality, and it puts us on pause. All right, so reboot the system. That's okay. Over the course of time, we will get to it and we will try a number of different things. Some of these different issues do take time to solve. The more mysterious it is, even as annoying as it might be, the harder it is going to be for some folks to tackle that. So I will tell you, one of the best things to do is work out an arrangement with the techs. Say, look, I'm bringing this to your attention. I know that a reboot will solve this. I'm going to go ahead and reboot it this time, but let's keep track of that. If you could keep track of it, and I'll keep track of it, we'll do this together. We'll see if we can find the commonality between when I have to reboot and when it works, and all of that. And you've got to track this. This is all about documentation. This is all about testing. And a lot of the different things that we might do as technicians, as far as repairing, we're not going to have the perfect solution the first time out. So we have to test these. I'm going to try this. I'm going to try that. Let's reboot it. And if it goes away, great for now. But let's keep track of it. Let's treat this over the long haul. Sometimes a simple problem is just like a stuck zipper. Getting it free without breaking the whole thing takes care and time. And in the workplace, cooperation. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Have you ever wondered how does ChatGPT know so much about everything? Here's what AI gets its knowledge from, where ChatGPT's knowledge comes from, and why it sounds so convincing. Sure, it sometimes gets things wrong, but other times, its knowledge can feel uncanny, like it knows so much about you, the world, and everything that's ever been written. But despite its confident tone and the mountain of information it can draw from, ChatGPT doesn't know everything. It certainly cannot think in the same way you and I can, even though it may seem that way. It's also not a god or some higher being. That's why it's more important than ever to understand how tools like ChatGPT actually work, what their limitations are, and how to get the most out of them. What is ChatGPT, and how does it work? ChatGPT is a large language model, otherwise with the acronym used, LLM, created by OpenAI. You can use it for free or pay for a subscription to access more advanced versions. These versions are known as models, and each one works a little differently. At its core, a large language model is a type of AI that's trained to predict text. It generates responses by predicting which words are most likely to come next in a sentence, and it's good at it. That's why ChatGPT can sound fluent, inform, and even witty. But it also doesn't really understand what you're saying. Sure, it understands language structure, but not the meaning or intent behind things in the same way a human would. This also explains why it sometimes gets things wrong and makes up facts entirely, which is known as hallucinating. The simplest way to think about it is to imagine a really advanced autocomplete. You give it a prompt, and it fills in what it thinks should come next based on everything it's seen before. Where does ChatGPT's knowledge come from? So, how does ChatGPT know so much? It all comes down to training data. ChatGPT was trained on an enormous amount of data, including books, articles, websites, code, Wikipedia pages, public Reddit threads, open source papers, and much, much more. The goal is to show it all of this information about the way humans write, explain, argue, joke, and connect ideas. This means that ChatGPT has seen a wide range of language styles and subjects, but it hasn't seen everything. And some ChatGPT models don't go on the internet in real time either. That is why you might have asked for information in the past, and it feels out of date. Its knowledge is often limited to what it was trained on, and in the case of some models, that training was frozen at a certain time. For example, that was June 2024 for GPT-4o, so it might not know the latest news or reflect newer cultural shifts. That said, some models do have browsing capabilities now, so it's worth checking which one you're using. This is usually displayed at the top of the screen in a drop-down menu. So training data is the foundation of what ChatGPT knows. But its answers are also shaped by what's known as reinforcement learning, which means it also learns from human feedback about what makes a helpful or accurate response. Did ChatGPT read all of the internet? This is where the things get a bit murky. Yes, some of the data used for training ChatGPT was collected by scraping publicly available content from the internet. That means tools like ChatGPT have read large parts of what's online, including public forums, blog posts, and documentation. Basically, anything that's openly accessible and not blocked by the site or copyright laws. Although the boundaries are blurry, AI companies have been criticized for using material like books from shadow libraries in their training data. Whether they should have used that content is part of ongoing debate and legal challenges around data ownership, consent, and ethics. But even though what these models have been trained on isn't always crystal clear, it's safe to say that ChatGPT hasn't read your private emails, public documents, or secret databases. At least, let's hope not. An important thing to note here is that because ChatGPT has learned so much from human-made content, it can sometimes reflect the same biases, gaps, and flaws that already exist in our culture and online spaces. How does ChatGPT decide what to say next? When you type a question into ChatGPT, it breaks your prompt into smaller units called tokens. It then uses everything it learned during its training to predict the next token, and the next one, and the next one, and the next one, until a full answer appears. This happens in real time, which is why the text often looks like it's being typed live. It is, in a way. Each word is a prediction, based on everything that came before it. This is also why some answers feel right, but somehow, weirdly, off because it's remixing words, not reasoning. If you want to dig deeper, there is a full guide about how ChatGPT knows what to say. So why does it seem like ChatGPT knows everything? If ChatGPT ever feels like it knows everything about you, that's down to its memory features. It can store important information in long-term memory and even remember things from all your past conversations. It's also incredibly good at sounding smart. Its responses often have the right structure, grammar, tone, and rhythm, because that's what it's been trained to mimic. So it creates the illusion that it always knows what it's talking about. But this fluency isn't the same as accuracy. Often it's useful, sometimes it's wrong, and sometimes it'll be confidently wrong, which is where things can get tricky if you're not paying attention, especially if you're not aware of how good it is at sounding confident and hyping you up too. The goal here isn't to scare you off AI tools altogether. It's to help you use ChatGPT more wisely. ChatGPT is a brilliant tool for sparking ideas, writing drafts, summarizing text, and even helping you think more clearly. But it's not magic. It's not sentient. And maybe most important of all, it's not always right. The more we understand what's really going on behind the curtain, the more we can use AI tools like ChatGPT with intention and not for the illusion of intelligence. Astronomers may have found existence of a ninth planet orbiting the sun beyond Pluto. It doesn't have a name yet. Pluto was discovered in 1930 and was initially classified as a ninth planet of our solar system, but it was reclassified as a dwarf planet in 2006 due to new astronomical definitions. Pluto is classified as a dwarf planet because it does not meet all the criteria set by the International Astronomical Union, that's the IAU, for full-size planets. Specifically, while Pluto orbits the Sun and has a round shape, it has not cleared its orbit of other objects, which is a requirement for full planet status. Additionally, its small size and icy composition contribute to its classification as a dwarf planet. The universe is a complete unknown to humans. We are not yet able to control and understand the system in which Earth is located, as evidenced by the possible discovery made by a group of astronomers from the University of Taiwan, who suggest that they may have found clues to the existence of a ninth planet. The solar system is currently known to be made up of eight planets: Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, apart from Pluto, which has long been considered a dwarf planet. But one more could join this select group, according to an infrared study carried out between 1986 and 2006. The work was based on data from the infrared astronomical satellite with the code word of IRAS and the Japanese satellite Akari, that's AKARI, which detected an object moving between 46.5 billion and 65.1 billion miles from the Sun, meaning it would take between 10,000 and 20,000 years to complete an orbit. Its mass would be 7 to 17 times that of Earth, making it what is known as an ice giant, similar to Neptune or Uranus, with temperatures around minus 200 degrees. But how was this new possible planet discovered? The study says it arises from anomalous patterns in the Kuiper Belt, an icy region beyond Neptune. The body appears in two historical images, so further observations are still needed to reach a conclusion, thus trying to confirm its orbit. In addition, it must be verified that it meets the requirements to be a planet, such as orbiting around a star, in this case the Sun, having sufficient mass for a spherical shape. This is accompanied by gravity, which must be strong enough, and clearing the area of its orbit, that is to say, having expelled or attracted other bodies of comparable size. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston joins me now, and Marty, You've got some Thunderbolt information for us.
Well, Thunderbolt, yes, but Thunderbolt and Thunderbolt 4 and okay. USB 4
okay.
are so close to the same that I consider them the same. Thunderbolt 5, that's a different, that's getting weird. But since you answer computer questions, here's one for you, and we'll sure. take weeks to answer it, right?
Okay.
You're stuck upgrading to Windows 11 because your computer won't. So when you get that replacement for that old relic that you've been running for years, if not mm-hmm. decades.
Yeah.
What do you need to do? What do you need to know, and what don't you want to do?
First up, back up the system. Back up all of your existing data. And then...
What?
External hard drives.
Oh, really?
I would...
Oh, we'll get into this.
Yeah, I would definitely get an external hard drive that is twice the size of the data that you've got right now. In the
recent, at all,
at least that would be a minimum.
I check my old relic. It's got 6 terabytes of storage,
okay.
jumbo boxes of disks and all that other stuff going on.
Sure.
And some of the new notebooks to replace it, half a terabyte. Really? Who's starting whom here?
Oh, yeah. The available onboard space seems to have held there at generally for laptops, right at that 1 terabyte amount for far longer than it should have. And
right now,
yeah,
if you do have a backup drive, right?
Yeah.
For optimum performance, what kind of connectors are going to go into?
Well, for the old system, you plug it into whatever you've got. Hopefully, you've got USB.
Yeah. But on the new,
you're
going to the notebook now. You got the new one. You've got USB-C for power, and what else do you have? Sometimes nothing.
Yeah.
Right.
Very true.
So, if you don't have enough ports. And you've already spent, you know, more than $50 to get a computer.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to buy something to give the computer more ports that's bigger and heavier than the computer and costs almost as much?
Yeah. So what you're referring to is docks. Yes. They used to refer to these as, it wasn't docking stations. What was the previous?
Hubs.
Hubs. That's another form of it. Yeah, there's all kinds of different ones out there.
There are now one of the big, and we're going to go through a variety. But I've got some examples that I want to talk about, and one of them is from. I'd like to pronounce it pluggable, but there's only one G instead of two, and I don't think they're cutting quarters. So I don't want you guys looking it up online and putting two Gs into the search engine, so I'll call it pluggable.
Okay. All right.
All right. This is the TBT4 UDX1. Everybody memorize that. Pluggable Thunderbolt 4 HDMI and more dock.
Okay.
So... if you're building for the future, if you're getting a new computer now, even if what you have right now doesn't have USB 4,
mm-hmm.
get that in your dock.
Yes.
USB.
Oh, yes.
USB,
definitely.
USB 5 is not out yet. Thunderbolt 5 is out.
Mm-hmm.
But Thunderbolt 5 is not necessarily backward compatible to USB 4. And if you don't have that computer yet, you got to make sure that it's going to be compatible one way or another.
Yeah.
Thunderbolt 4, USB 4 work fine. Substituting for each other. Now, this little box, and none of these are little, right? But it's fast. It's really good. Think of 4 in USB 4 Thunderbolt 4 as 40, because it can carry 40 gigabits per second across the wire.
Okay, yeah.
40 gigabits per second. You're not going to want to compromise on that.
Mm-mm.
Because, you know, you're going to get as old as you get. Wouldn't you rather spend less time of it waiting for your computer, right?
Yes, definitely.
Now, this pluggable Thunderbolt 4 certified laptop docking station, pluggable, mm-hmm. And you don't have to change anything to the same USB-C ports to handle either Thunderbolt 4 or USB 4. Either way, you're routing 40 gig per second to the host. Mm-hmm. Now, before I get to the signaling carriage, yeah. This slender package offers 96-watt charging using its own 20-volt brick.
Okay.
There's a UHS-II SD card slot. There's audio in and out, four USB-A ports at 10 gig, three times the ports for Thunderbolt 4 or USB 4.
Nice.
An HDMI port for a single monitor up to 8K, or use its included USB-C to HDMI adapter to run two 4K monitors. And just so I don't forget, you can plug right into 2.5 gig Ethernet. It's about $210 on Amazon.
Okay. All right. That sounds like a really good one. I like the specs you're listing off there. That sounds pretty much state of the art there.
Yeah, it's tempting, and it's a delicious appetizer.
And I'm guessing it's probably going to work not only for the Windows users but the Mac users as well. The Thunderbolt.
Oh, I would say even Linux has hope.
I don't know about that one. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting IDs. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, June the 26th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is bcug.com. TED Ed Connect meets Tuesday, July the 1st. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Hybrid meeting. Meeting at the Scarsdale Public Library, located at 54 Olmsted Road in Scarsdale, New York, and online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, July 4th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. The website is acgnj.org. The King's Byte Computer Club meets Tuesday, July 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Park Plaza Restaurant, located at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. The phone number to call is 347-278-7320. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, July 10th, 2025, at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, July the 11th, 2025. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And the website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, Marty Winston, and Mark Brownstein, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.